Welcome to Looks Like New on KGNU's It's the Economy. Looks Like New is a show that asks old questions about new tech. We join you every month on the old-fashioned radio, or you can listen online as a podcast. Looks Like New is a production of the Media Economies Design Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder. This month, our guest is Matt Dryhurst, hosted by Andy DeLalo.
Matt Dryhurst is a Berlin-based artist, musician, and technologist whose diverse practice engages deeply with questions of creativity, collective ownership, and the governance of emerging technologies. Best known for his collaborations alongside musician Holly Herndon, Matt recently co-led the exhibition The Call at London's Serpentine Galleries, which examined collective forms of data governance and AI stewardship. Their recent book, All Media is Training Data, chronicles a decade of Herndon and Dryhurst's artworks and evolving perspectives on cultural production. Matt is also a co-founder of Spawning, an initiative advocating for creator rights and transparency in AI training. In this episode of Looks Like New, we discuss how DIY music culture shaped Matt's approach to technology and AI. Matt shares insights from his experiments with collective data stewardship and emphasizes the critical role cultural institutions can play in building trusted frameworks for AI governance. We also explore the urgent need for transparency in AI systems, possibilities for public interest AI infrastructure, and how rethinking data ownership can empower communities. Matt, welcome to Looks Like New.
Thanks, Andy. Nice to meet you.
So I just want to say right off the top, I've been following your work for a while and really admire not only the scope, but also the depth of what you do. For listeners of the show, I'm hoping to trace some through lines in your work specifically around creative ownership, collective infrastructure, and how artists can shape the future of AI. And I've got probably more questions than we have time for, so I'm just going to dive right in. You got your start in the independent music scene, and for well over a decade now, you've collaborated with your partner, Holly Herndon, on some pretty cutting-edge art meets tech projects. Among these, you spent your time specifically working with custom-trained AI models like Spawn and Holly Plus. How did the work you were doing with record labels and DIY culture inform the way you approached AI or are approaching AI? And the work you've done with ownership and data rights.
Yeah, that's a good one. I take it back even further, if I'm honest. I mean, Holly and I met. We've been together nearly 20 years, and I'm 40 now. So about 20 years ago, I started working at the independent record label in London. That's actually how I met Holly first. So engagement with that kind of DIY music culture goes back really, really long. And I think that's really the term, the DIY part, right? So, you know, we spent a long time in music, spent a long time touring. I mean, both Holly and I have toured in various capacities again for 20 years. Like, this is our entire life. We're very committed people in that sense. So, but I guess the big kind of switch happened. Holly got into a grad school in Northern California. And so we moved over there together. And at the time, I actually had barely any interest in tech stuff, to be honest. It was peripheral, you know, but it became really clear. We actually moved there during the 2008 financial crisis. and I was like, oh, wait, I have no skills that anyone in San Francisco values. So I have to like learn about this tech stuff. And of course, there's two sides to that, right? There's the standard kind of like startup job kind of path. And then there's a whole culture, a very rich culture in that part of the world, as there is in many parts of the world, of DIY tech. So I guess that just from putting together music or art or whatever we were doing, the principle was always, you know, okay, if we're going to integrate this tech or explore it, we want to know how it works. We want to, we've both found a kind of passion in that where you don't know until you start trying, right? Where we're like, you just fall further down the rabbit hole. And so, yeah, any tech that we end up playing with, we want to know how it works, if only just to understand the scope of possibility, right? Like, you're like, okay, if you have an idea, it's better to understand the tools because you just get more ideas as to what you can end up doing with them, you know? And so whether it's, you know, some of the crypto stuff, I mean, like, or decentralized networks, for example, which I got very deeply interested in going back to like 2010 or something like this. There was a little kind of scene of people who are interested in kind of federated publishing and so on and so forth. or the machine learning stuff, our point of principle is really just to try and understand things as well as possible, just to know what the, you know, what's there, you know, and it becomes increasingly more important, obviously, because increasingly, I don't think it's controversial to say that tech companies, so that, you know, the most heavily capitalized, the most prominent are kind of culturally relevant institutions now, for better or worse, whether they take that role seriously or not is a whole thing. And so increasingly, I think that like our approach, and this is novel, I mean, there's been plenty of people I think have taken a similar approach over the years, is kind of important because it becomes important to not really just be like making tech demos, you know. and it's really our position, maybe we'll get into this a bit later, that it's kind of important to understand the affordances, understand how these systems are made, because actually abstractions in how the systems are implemented, or, you know, modifications to software, can actually then have big downstream cultural impact. If you take the thesis that these, you know, these decisions, we've been calling that protocol art, we can maybe get into it, but like this idea that if you take the our thesis, at least, that, you know, a software engineer at Facebook has actually a lot of power in culture, it only then makes sense that if you were thinking about, you know, building something with cultural resonance, you would start looking upstream of the production of media and actually at the software or the protocol layer.
Yeah, and I think that leads me to a really my next point here, which is a lot of your work that you do, you really point out how much impact the data that goes into these AI models really has an effect on the output that you get. So many people, we have this relationship where we just like generate an image on ChatGPT or whatever, and not really realizing that the data, how much of an important role that plays. And a big issue, obviously, in art right now is that these AI systems can mimic an artist's style by training on their work, usually without the artist's permission. A recent case study of this is like the flood of images converted into the Studio Ghibli style that's been kind of going across the internet. So non-disclosure of data sets prevents the public from knowing to what extent a company like OpenAI is training their model on images they don't have a license to use. And you, Holly, and Jordan Meyer co-founded an initiative called Spawning to let creators opt in or opt out of having their work used as training data for AI. So why do you feel it's important for artists to have a say in that specific way, whether their art feeds these AI models? And how do you think how can we think about ownership or credit around something like style that doesn't fit into conventional copyright laws?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, first off, just to take the point about the role of that data in AI models, I mean, we've been banging on this drum for a long time, and actually increasingly industry is kind of reaching this conclusion, or putting forward this conclusion, that the model is the data, right? I mean, it is remarkable the amount you can compress into a model, but, you know, the outputs of model basically are aggregations of the data that go in. There's no extra magic. I mean, there is kind of a theory that I do actually think has some legs, that when you get to a wide enough, you know, corpus of data, so billions of images, that those combinations can actually produce new things, right? But they produce new things from the sum total of the data ingested, right? And that's actually where the complication comes. And we'll probably get into this with my very idiosyncratic position on the whole IP question. But basically, we've been thinking about this for some time. We made a bunch of art about it, particularly this idea of kind of sharing models of yourselves, you know, like Holly Plus. We also made a bunch of work with OpenAI's Clip, which is the text kind of the text model that allows for you to type someone's name or type the name of something and produce something in their image, largely because we find it really fascinating. And also because quite, you know, handily, Holly happened to have an embedding in Clip, and so we could actually explore it through her, you know, with her permission, and like, you know, make artwork about it, because it's kind of interesting. But so yeah, we put together Spawning with Jordan and Patrick Hupner, actually, to try and like just bring some clarity to this question, just because it's a really wicked, interesting, like delicious problem, you know. And so we released a website called haveibeentrained.com that's still up, that allows for you, to the best of our knowledge, to see whether you're likely in these data sets. And then on top of that said, okay, cool. Well, you know, if we can tell with some degree of certainty who might be in these, wouldn't it be fun to prototype a maybe a different approach to IP, give it like kind of move past copyright is interesting and flawed for many reasons. You know, I get a lot of grief from people online with my position on this, but I think it's again rather uncontroversial to say that copyright wasn't really designed for this purpose. The way these models work are just more complicated. They're a 21st century kind of problem. And so we're like, well, I generally am pro consent and pro AI. So would it really damage these companies to observe an opt-out registry, right? So we built one. We've collected, I think it's at minimum 2 billion individual opt-outs at this point, and then use that as a bit of a launch pad to go and have policy discussions both with companies and with governments to say, hey, what if we had imagination about this IP issue rather than seeing it through a very narrow, I would argue, kind of 20th century lens of, you know, being pro copyright means being pro artist, which I think is a controversial statement, or being fully permissive in the sense of, you know, free information, classic free information advocacy, which also I would argue is maybe a little naive in this context, right? Because as much as I think that there's a lot more going on with AI models than simply the ripping off of people, I think that that's too crude an analysis of what's going on. You also can't have it that a few companies with the most compute or the most budget get to benefit from everything, from everything without, you know, there's all kind of competition problems there and almost antitrust problems maybe. And so we were like, look, in order to try and provoke new imagination about why IP could be moving forward, let's just kind of invent a new protocol for manners here and say, what if the likelihood is that less than 5% of people opt their data out, models will work just fine. Those people can have their data for their own purposes. And if you can try and kind of advocate for that position, then you get into all kind of interesting new domains of, you know, maybe asking for that position to apply with Facebook or Instagram, or, you know, because the wicked problem with this question generally is that we're not really starting from scratch, right? In the case of data, most people don't know this, which is why the copyright question is so fraught. In order to even express yourself online now, you're already signing over irrevocable training rights to Google, YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, so on and so forth, right? And so any measure to be too harsh on training is ultimately just a gimme to five companies, you know? So we're like, look, maybe if you can demonstrate to people that opt-out works, we actually have demonstrated that it can work. A few companies used it, and we have kind of put measures in place to make it even more robust going forward. You know, maybe then you can start having a more imaginative conversation about IP moving forward, rather than simply shutting things down or letting companies do what the hell they want. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And beyond the like individual control and preferences, like the opt-in, opt-out that you're talking about, you've also explored more collective ways of governing creative data. Your recent project, The Call, at Serpentine Galleries, had you working with 15 community choirs across the UK to create a data set for an AI choral model, setting up something called a choral data trust. So all the singers who contributed became stakeholders in how that AI model can be used. What did you learn from experimenting with groups in this way, beyond just like individual opt-in, opt-out, having a say in the AI's development, like every stage really. And do you think this kind of collective ownership or governance of a data set could be a model for how we handle creative AI projects in the future?
Yeah. I mean, we learned a lot. I think that, so for the Serpentine exhibition, part of it was that we wanted to make the whole idea, thinking again about protocols, was we wanted to make a different protocol for training, factoring the things that we might care about, right? And we said, okay, would it be possible to train a model based on, you know, the data of these 15 choirs, you know, a smaller group of people that could produce beautiful music? And as such, could you also produce kind of IP primitives or maybe just different habits to allow for them to have some say as to where the data goes? So, you know, we tried to be pretty good about that in the sense that we also had to negotiate to use their voices for the show and so on and so forth, which feels consistent. And I mean, learned a fair deal. I think that the challenge with any of this is really scale. So where we stood, the experiment worked. Everyone seemed relatively happy with the process. We had a data delegate who was kind of delegated to express the wishes of the group, because obviously there's a lot of people involved, and you know, and everyone seemed ultimately happy with the success story. It was the nice thing too, of course, is that dealing with their voice data, it's less sensitive than health data or anything that might actually end up being a bit more consequential going forward. I think that there's a lot of promise actually to these kind of collective agreements. In the past, I mean, I wrote a piece, must be 6 or 7 years ago for Venice Biennial. This is a long time ago. Specifically about data guilds, you know, thinking about this process of being like, you know, very much also kind of inspired by the crypto moment and some of the more kind of progressive ideas in the Ethereum community of saying, okay, you know, what if you did just kind of see contribution to some, to a greater a community of people as a, you know, as an opportunity or as kind of like a commitment. And so, and I think the challenge when you start talking about AI though is really, it's really a scale issue. So if you think about like a GPT or the most advanced multimodal models that we use, you're talking about really general data, billions of contributions. Maybe that's an understatement. I can't really tell because they don't tell us what they're training on. And so these kind of collective efforts, you know, are maybe cute in the short term, but I think are instructive more so when you think about things like national policy or potentially international policy. So one area that we've looked at a lot is this idea of the public domain, which regrettably is very outmoded at this point in time. So, you know, with Spawning, for example, we put together the largest ever corpus of public domain data for training. We released a data set called PD12M. It's very high quality. We're actually training a model on it at the moment called Public Diffusion. And the one thing we learned from that is, look, we tried to find all the public domain data possible, and there's not a lot of it. Right. So 12 million really high quality images is great, but you compare that to what a Flux would be trained on, where you're talking about, you know, in the billions. It's really a drop in the ocean. And so these kind of collective models, I think, will make the most sense either with some kind of new kind of imagination or commitment of people to say, actually, rather than posting to Twitter, I'd rather post or cross post to some kind of a public network, or when it comes to national policy, where one of the suggestions, for example, in the UK, I've been trying to make is saying, well, what if you were to consider national data to be a kind of public resource? What kind of, you know, what kind of new arrangements could be thought of in that paradigm, right? Like, could you exchange, for example, greater public services in return for an agreement that people are, you know, perhaps anonymously or with some safeguards in place, contributing to a national corpus of data that contributes, you know, that benefits UK business or UK public services or so on and so forth. So really the prototype in itself was a very lean way to explore some of those bigger ideas. But on principle, I think it could work. The challenge really is just scale. Yeah.
So speaking of scale, the call was done with an art institution serving as a trusted data intermediary. Is the word I think you used, which points to this bigger picture of cultural institutions playing a role in shaping how AI is used, kind of like what you're talking about right now. And so in this talk around AI and data as a public resource rather than leaving it all in private hands, I don't know, kind of like how libraries or public broadcasters serve in the public interest. Like, what role specifically do you see museums, universities, or other cultural institutions playing in the future of AI and creative tech? And can you imagine building a sort of public or community-run AI infrastructure, like hosted by a library, for example? And how might that change who benefits from these technologies?
Absolutely. Honestly, it's something that we're thinking a lot about at the moment. I think a couple of things, right? It turns out that institutions like what you've mentioned, libraries, so on and so forth, you know, I think without even changing what they do, already could offer a lot to machine learning development. I try to make this distinction between, you know, there's a lot of conversations about content right now, right? Like, so people being concerned about their picture being taken and used in a multi-billion data set, quite the relative harms of that are debatable. I think the more interesting conversation when it comes to this is context, right? So when you look, for example, in any domain where you're maybe a specialist, so if I happen to be a specialist maybe in art, or culture, right? So if I go and query GPT, the funny thing is, with it being trained kind of wantonly on the commercial web, you end up getting, like, you know, there's a critique of the commercial internet anyway. If I ask it a rather boilerplate question about art, it will give me back exactly what I assume it will give me back, because it's almost like the equivalent of like the Google image search or Google search, right? Where it's like, of course, if I were to mention data and AI, I know the first three names that will come up because the most has been written about those names or something like this. What's interesting, I think, about cultural institutions is, you know, they have huge potential to produce a great deal more context for narrow applications like this, right? So the idea that GPT ultimately would displace the need for someone to go to an art school or, you know, or for a large art institution to exist is just false, right? Rather, what everybody, whether you're an artist or an institution, probably has to swallow right now is that they are going to have to exist in a media and information environment that involves these models. And so my encouragement would be to say, hey, like, look at what you're really strong at already, and then find ways to participate further in this new habit, because people are going to want to navigate. I mean, I'm obsessed with using LLMs. I think they're remarkable, but they have limitations that could be filled by these institutions. Similarly, I also just think that, you know, being an artist in this context, I think, like, it gets a bit messy, because obviously with Spawning, we started a company, so we are somewhat participating in the private market, even though, you know, we aren't charging for anything that we do. It's kind of important for there to be entities, whether they be academic or institutional, that are asking questions and piloting experiments that there really is very little incentive for Google to pursue, you know, which is not to create a false dichotomy of evil companies, good institutions, even though in some cases that may be true. Rather, just to say that, you know, a lot of companies are very constrained by a particular mission, right? And when it comes to art, you know, we've had this argument many times, right? These image models are remarkable. The GPT image model, for example, that caused all the fuss with the Ghiblis, it's a work of art. It is unbelievable. It is so good, right? But these models, ultimately, when people discuss art, which is a very embattled term, you know, they have this kind of objective function to produce really cool pictures, right? To a lot of people, art is pictures. To art institutions, art is far richer and far more complicated and nuanced than that. It turns out that there are very few organizations, large companies, who are doing research factoring that art is far more nuanced than pictures, right? And so without saying one is bad or one is good, rather, I just think there's so much more room for people with different perspectives to get involved in this conversation. The challenge, I think, is that, and I've definitely suffered this a little bit, for various reasons, there has been a growing narrative that you have tech companies who are bad guys, and then the role of institutions is to resist bad guys. That's right. Which in some cases I think is qualified, but I think it's rather kind of short-sighted, you know. And so I think our position, which is occasionally unfashionable, but I hope is actually doing more good than harm, is to say, no, like, I believe in this technology. It's a general purpose technology. I believe it will be incredibly consequential. It's actually incumbent on institutions, academic institutions, so on and so forth, to represent their interests on this substrate, right? We need to get involved with it, because as much as you might want to kind of throw slander out on Twitter or Blue Sky, you know, which occasionally can be in complete denial about the reordering of the global economy, in terms of AI, as much as it might be cathartic to do that, you actually do need to participate in this process, right? And it will be far more, I believe it will just be far more kind of effective to represent institutions as being even more essential in light of this next information substrate, rather than simply define themselves as being not interested in it or something, which in some cases is at least the official line at the moment. So I think there's so much room for institutions to play a role here. And I think also the good news is it doesn't require changing the fundamental goals of the institution. Where, you know, when you talk about libraries, you're talking about preserving knowledge, increasing access to rich amounts of knowledge. When you talk about art museums, it's about preserving art history, preserving or encouraging kind of a wider, you know, a multiple vantage points on culture rather than reducing it down to the exchange of a few pictures or whatever. Yeah. So if anything, getting involved in this AI game, you don't even need to kind of shift your vantage point on the world, rather just try and find a way to represent it through this new tool set. So I'm very interested in that and working on a couple of things that I think complement that idea, you know.
And so a lot of these ideas, whether collective data efforts or public interest AI, come down to trust. And right now for a lot of people, as we kind of mentioned earlier, AI systems are pretty much black boxes for a lot of people. It's hard for the public to know exactly what data went into them or even to tell when AI is being used. I know you've been advocating for more transparency around how AI models are trained and deployed. We talked about some of the spawning tools. I know you've put out even more tools other than, you know, have I been trained with spawning? So why is it so important to pull back the curtain on AI in this way? What would it look like if we had more openness about AI, how AI worked? For example, like if an AI generated piece or platform had like a nutrition label with its training data, or you know, if companies were upfront about when and how they use AI, how might that kind of transparency help both creators and everyday users trust and engage with these tools?
Good question. I mean, this is obviously an ideological position. I think that I'm generally pro transparency about everything, because I think that oftentimes, so let's just talk about the opacity of current AI image models. One, it can produce confusion, and it can produce confusion that both benefits and I think also harms, let's say, AI companies, right? In the case, you could say it benefits them. In one case, you could say it benefits them because, you know, it may insulate them from certain lawsuits, right? We could say that that's probably the case, right? In another case, you could say it benefits them because there has been a lot of, I think, kind of overblown, hyperbolic kind of excitement about AI models, where because of the transparency there, people believe they are just magic and they don't necessarily understand the complexity of, well, actually what I consider to be the real magic of it, which is that, you know, linear algebra plus all the data and compute equals remarkable cognitive systems. Like, you know, that you don't have to believe it's conscious, for example, or whatever, to appreciate the majesty of this tech, right? Yeah. But generally, I think transparency is good in all cases. I take the example for, you know, when you look at, for example, the copyright debate or culture more broadly, as a cultural participant for a long time, you know, I used to kind of put forward this idea of interdependence, right? And the basic idea from that was saying, as independent music went from being this kind of decentralized, you know, a group of people who had a very different protocol of living and became more of like a fetishized thing, particularly around Web 2, right, where everybody wanted to be these independent actors that had a laptop at home and could publish a podcast, you know, you kind of, you know, people kind of missed the point. The point being that actually what made all of those independent musical or art cultures or literature cultures so rich was the interdependence of them, was that it wasn't about unique individuals. Rather, it was about the fact that, okay, of course, some special individuals emerged out of the coordinated activity of lots and lots of people, right? The more transparency is brought to how AI models work, there is actually a real analogy to be made there. In a sense, you could then start believing, as I do, that AI models are fundamentally a cultural technology, right? You have large groups of people without whom these models would not work. When you get an output, that output is the responsibility of everybody who went into the model, and nobody in particular. That's a very beautiful, I think, it's a very beautiful way to understand these models, and opacity prevents us from having a common understanding of that being what a model is. And I think that, you know, greater transparency around these systems, it's good for education, it's good for people just having a you know, more of an understanding of how the sausage gets made. But fundamentally beyond that, I think it starts inviting more interesting questions about, you know, the nature of creation, more interesting questions about different economic configurations that could be negotiated because of this kind of interdependent reality. you know, and by extension, more interesting conversations about IP and so on and so forth. So in a sense, I think greater transparency kind of exposes fragile myths, you know? And so that's why I would endorse it. I think, you know, beyond, I think some legitimate concern about, you know, wanting greater transparency because you don't want OpenAI to win everything or whatever. I think that's legitimate, but I think there's a bigger mission to this, which is, you know, more transparency allows for us to see things clearer and as such come to more imaginative conclusions about how we could live going forward, which I think we need a great deal more imagination on this issue and in particular on some of the externalities of this tech. I'm almost kind of concerned about how little imagination there is about that currently, because you see the tech coming, getting better and better, and the conversation in parallel to that about how we are going to deal with the fallout of this, just kind of, you know, firing blanks. Like so greater transparency, I think, just helps bring more people on board to have those discussions.
Yeah, and this really does lend itself back to what you're talking about, how cultural institutions can play a role here, and especially around interdependence, because I think, like what you were trying to talk about previously, where it really seems like cultural institutions in a lot of ways have like seeded that narrative to big tech around emerging technologies. At least it feels that way in a lot of ways. And I think that people, it's hard for people to trust these big tech companies have their interests, you know, their best interests in mind when trying to work together towards, you know, developing like new copyright laws or things like that. And I feel like this is where cultural institutions really can take a role in having the best interests of people in mind to like kind of push these things forward. And one example of that, of this sort of, I don't know, this trust issue, maybe even a literacy issue as well with people for many reasons, is in the call. I remember some of the folks that were kind of designing the protocols around it and working on the governance structures of the project. They talked about how when you approach these choirs with a term of service agreement, that they kind of by default thought that they were signing away their rights, as opposed to here are your rights and here's how we're going to advocate for you as a cultural institution. And so even when the institutions step in to kind of play this role with people, again, from this small sample size of the call, people like don't maybe have an understanding of how to create that interdependence specifically around emerging technologies.
No, I think you're totally right. I mean, the topic of, you know, trust with these companies. I mean, in some ways, I have to say, I do know quite a few people who work within these companies, and it's one of those chaotic things where, you know, both kind of at high level company operations and also government, there's kind of a like, you know, be careful how much you see, in the sense that you know, in a way, it's like the classic line of like, you know, conspiracy theories are actually kind of a lullaby. They're actually a cope, because the truth is far more chaotic, and that's actually far more disconcerting, the idea, you know. So if anything, I mean, with some of these companies, I'm sometimes a bit kind of, I sometimes think that they do actually, many people that do actually have the best of intentions, and you just have this kind of, you know, there's bigger missions at play, and there's kind of nobody really driving, you know, and that's really one of the roles, I think, that exactly where institutions can step in, and also the state can play a role. I also agree with you that I think, you know, when you're dealing with institutions, I mean, ceding responsibility in that way has been quite common. We saw this a lot with, let's say, the Web2 economy. And a lot of this also comes down to literacy again, that you have a lot of incredibly skilled, incredibly kind of wise people who train their whole lives without having to think about technological infrastructure, you know. And I've thrown this criticism at, let's say, academic systems before, that they were pretty slow to reform the education system to be able to give people the tools to be able to have these conversations. But the time has kind of come now where, you know, where I think it really is kind of critical for people to at least have some people around who have a pretty decent idea of this. You know, having dealt a little bit with some kind of state government infrastructure in the past too, it's also really striking, almost to such an extent that I end up sympathizing with tech companies sometimes, where you see the level of literacy on the more regulatory side, and I'm like, oh boy, this is really a problem. You know, that you can sometimes understand the libertarian impulse to kind of just build systems outside of it. But to your point, the challenge here is, I mean, in all order, like when you start bringing up law stuff, most people switch off. When you start talking about data, most people switch off. When you start talking about finance, I mean, it's one of the huge issues where even some of the best intent, like some of the most fascinating kind of crypto projects also fell flat for people, because then you're talking, you know, you're talking about, you know, financial instruments and so on and so forth. And people are like, whoa, wait a second. Like, you know, it's good. It's good in the sense that people have this kind of, it's good that they have an internal kind of skepticism. That's always probably a good impulse to have. But regrettably, when you're dealing with these systems, you are going to have to have, you have to factor commerce, you have to factor IT, you have to factor legalese, so on and so forth, in order to be able to understand them well enough to be able to have imagination about what could be done, you know. And so the big opportunity again is with institutions, academics, so on and so forth, really just to say, hey, like most of what you're already doing is very valuable, at least by my judgment, but how could you find a way to express your values in this new context? But that's the interesting challenge. It's like, you don't have to become a software developer, you know what I mean? Because they're also kind of imperiled by all this stuff, it turns out. But rather, like, you know, how can you find a way to step into the tent and give voice to your concerns without, you know, yeah, ultimately, functionally, exactly, ceding control over to a small group of people who I think sometimes are also not that comfortable playing that role, you know? I've seen this, you know, with leadership at some of the AI companies, that they'll come out and say, like, hey, we shouldn't be in charge. You know, like we're interested. We're building this tech. Someone's going to build it. It might be us. It will be the Chinese. It will be someone like that. This is just going to happen. Please, can somebody step in and start having big ideas about where this goes? You know, so it's it's one of those things again, like you know, moving up to the front of a plane and then realizing there's no pilot. it's like there's people on the AI side too who I think have existential dread about that as well. So this is a great time for social scientists and political thinkers and so on and so forth to actually bring some of their expertise into this domain. But it has to happen quickly, because you know things are happening quickly.
Absolutely. And I think this is, again, really something that I feel like you all modeled really well within the call by, like what you mentioned earlier, the data steward, like having a specific role where not everyone needs to necessarily get up to speed with how these things are working, but just like a new role that someone can fill within cultural institutions or wherever, that is sort of an intermediary. Like the cultural institution itself is an intermediary, but there's specific people or a person who is sort of trying to, and another thing that you all worked on in the call too, is like leveraging and harnessing that collective bargaining power of people's data, really. And the fact that, like we said earlier, these AI models don't have anything if they don't have data, you know, and granted, all this stuff is already out there online and so forth. And a lot of it's been scraped with, you know, Common Crawl and like that, but just like moving forward, you know, how to harness that collective data power, how to use it, how, you know, what your rights are, and like maybe new emerging roles within institutions like a data steward that will help shepherd that.
Absolutely. And that's part of the reason I've been interested in guilds for so long, to be honest, because obviously, you know, most people are familiar with the idea of a union, right? So a union being a collective body that is employed by one specific industry, right? And so there's union and union action, so on and so forth. Some of that I support, some of it I think is maybe antiquated in some context. But guilds are kind of interesting, because then you're talking about artisans that choose to say, hey, we've got a lot of power here, right? We could structure labor relations very differently by simply moving forward. And I think the one thing that most people miss, so I'll give you an example. I was talking to someone yesterday. I don't know if I can disclose who it is, but I was talking to someone yesterday who was speaking to a pretty prominent special effects team. So the special effects team, they've won awards, they take on big clients, the biggest clients, right? And you would think, given the discourse about, let's say, art being scraped and, you know, that only benefiting AI companies, the common discourse you'd read in the press, you'd think they'd be really annoyed about this AI stuff. You know, you take my data, now Hollywood won't hire us anymore because they can just generate that stuff themselves. And what was funny is they took the exact opposite approach. They went, with open source AI models and our skills, which are incredibly valuable for the production of media, those combined will allow for us to supersede the industries that used to employ us, right? So they're thinking completely differently. They're like, we have lots of really skilled people. Our really skilled people plus these tools equals perhaps a far more equitable arrangement than we could ever get petitioning clients that used to be our only way to unlock these kind of budgets or whatnot, right? And so that's, again, I think that, you know, you can take some of the best ideas of collective action in this case, but marry that with principles that I hold very dear, such as open source technology, public domain data, so on and so forth, in order to propose new structures that might be better than what you ever had with the old entertainment industry, for example. You know, and I think that kind of logic, I mean, in the short term is it's slightly unfashionable because there's many people who are very on the fence about this whole AI question. I also feel they're getting fed a lot of poor information. But long term, that's what I mean by imaginative structures. You can do a great deal there if you understand, point one, the models are the data. Point two, you know, if you are someone that is very skilled, that does bring a lot of value here, you know, you now have new options to fork away from the career path that you maybe thought you were on, where you might not need to bargain with anybody, right? And so I think there's a lot that can be done in this particular sense, but we're not quite there yet. I mean, to your point as well with the data delegate, this is also something that I've been waiting. There's kind of private bets everywhere about, you know, when the first kind of AI election is going to be, right? When's it going to be a big talking point? Maybe 28 in the States or whatever. I mean, who knows? But I think this is also something that from piloting it a little bit, and I take only a small amount of credit because there were a lot of people working on that project, you know, thinking about people in political positions, whether they be state political positions or within new kind of structures that are being born, that can assume a kind of the role of a politician in that sense, that have representatives. Again, crypto, you know, there's been tons of experiments in this. Delegate voting is very common within those protocols. That's also really interesting to me. You know, the idea that you would have representatives that you delegate some degree of responsibility to, and you also trust them that they know the ins and outs of this stuff. Because I have to concede myself, I mean, I consider myself, it's a bit weird to me that I am an expert on this, to be honest, because I kind of fell into it. But you have to follow this stuff daily to understand where things are going. And a lot of people have kids, they have jobs, they don't have the time to do that, right? Politicians, as we traditionally understand them, do not have the time to do that, as we have learned. Thinking about more, whether they're formal or informal delegates who can actually grapple with this stuff in real time is a big piece of this puzzle, because the one group of people who do have both the funds and the motivation to follow this stuff in real time are tech companies, you know? And so almost, not even that they're doing it maliciously, you know, but the asymmetry and the of resources and the latency between what the person, the dev at Google knows and the person on the street knows, that latency is getting wider and wider as these conversations are getting more and more consequential. So I almost don't blame anybody except for acknowledging the fact that latency needs to be shortened really quick, you know? And the danger, of course, is that it gets shortened in ways that are also deleterious to society, which are, you know, the regulation, for example, that just shuts down what would be very beneficial tech because you get a populist uprising against something that people don't understand, right? Which I don't think is necessarily on the horizon, but these are all the concerns one might have with not tightening that latency. The major concern I have ultimately, and I think we've seen this over the past 10 to 15 years, is ultimately within tech, and I've benefited from this a little bit myself, without tightening that latency, you end up ostensibly having a breakaway civilization of characters who are far more aware of, you know, the stakes. They're far more aware of the different conditions that are shaping the economy. And ultimately, from a moral perspective, I don't, that doesn't sit very well with me. You know what I mean? that's not good. So yeah, I mean, riddle me this. I don't know how to solve that problem in particular, but I think that there are some informal or potentially formal structures that could be proposed to just to compensate for that. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think I find it really interesting that the more we dive into this AI conversation, it seems that we get closer and closer to like the human layer of these problems, how, like, for example, some of the concerns around AI, particularly in the US, I mean, obviously there's a whole technical concern. I don't want to minimize that at all, but a lot of it also has to do with the fact that there's like a breakdown in civic solidarity in a lot of ways, in some ways, like Web 2 atomized us so much that it's hard for us to have these conversations where we are, you know, organizing together towards, you know, again, collective bargaining towards our data and things like that, or how our data is being used, or even again, the literacy, the latency that we're talking about too. So I find it interesting that these discussions kind of like funnel their way back down to a very fundamentally like human layer. And I'm just curious, as we kind of like get close to the end here, like what I know we've talked about the call extensively today, but I'm curious, like, are there any other projects that you see that are sort of trending in that direction of you know, I don't know, public AI and sort of creating that civic discourse around AI and kind of bringing people together around these ideas?
Absolutely. Yeah. There's a few. There's a group, I think, led by a guy called Joshua Tan, that has put forward a kind of, I don't want to say a manifesto, but basically a statement on public AI. I know they're doing a lot of work on that. There's a group with Tony Lai at Stanford, Primavera Di Filippi, who's also always great to follow on this stuff, looking at different IP structures. There are, who else? It's a rather small group. I'm probably also missing a ton of people. I mean, I know in crypto, for example, there's a lot of energy. There's a group called Prime Intellect that's working a lot on decentralized training infrastructure, releasing kind of open models that are trained on and owned by large groups of people who contribute compute. It's a pretty exciting project. There's a few others. There's something called Pluralis that CoinFund is involved with. There's Jake from CoinFund has put a lot of time and resources into supporting maybe different visions for decentralized AI. There's a lot of really cool stuff out there. On the human layer, I think what's really interesting, I mean, one of the reason why, I mean, going back to like 2017, we really narrowed in on group singing, right? We were thinking about like pre-modern art making as kind of being more instructive than romantic modern conceptions of art making when it comes to this stuff. Is my position on the human is twofold, right? It may well turn out that everything we understood from 20th century industry does mutate or change drastically. That doesn't mean art goes away. Art is a human need. Art, I would argue, is you know, consensus around meaning. You know, so you don't need that to go through a record label in the traditional sense for it to occur. You know, that's one part. The second part is, I think that the human layer is also so fundamental to the furthering of AI research. There's a great kind of computer scientist I recommend called Ken Stanley, who actually recently led the open-endedness team at OpenAI. I think he had a lot to do with one of the more recent models, GPT models, that was released. I mean, he wrote a great book called Why Greatness Can't Be Planned. And long story short, it's basically a criticism of kind of the objective, where his argument is, and this is very reductive, but his argument is that when you often talk to people who came to remarkable conclusions, they didn't come to those conclusions because they sat down and wrote a list and said, first you do this, then you do that, then you do this, and then we discover gravity. Actually, the paragon of human accomplishment or human thought tends to be a very intuitive process. And so oftentimes he has this amazing analogy where he talks about crossing a river. There's a bunch of stones on the river and you cross the river in the fog. And if you chose and you plotted out which stone to go on, you might never cross the river. But if you intuit your way through it, afterwards you might be able to chart a path for other people to follow you. You know, this is maybe, you can create analogies to the scientific process, right? This is like a lot of great scientists, you know, they do all the hard work to understand everything, and then they just follow things in a certain, you know, they end up following their gut or whatever that means. And I couldn't help but feel like listening to Ken Stanley being like, this is the best justification for cultural institutions I've ever heard, right? Because when you talk about public funding or, you know, public funding for media, which is what we're participating in right now, right? It's very, very difficult to explain things like ROI, right? You're like, how much are we currently contributing to the public? You know, could you put a dollar amount on it? No, you can't really, right? It's very disappointing when you view culture in this way, as some people will want to do, looking at numbers, right? Streaming numbers. Is the most streamed song ever more important than, you know, the national epic of Egypt? No, probably not, right? Like, and so there's this interesting alliance that I believe once we sober ourselves and maybe tone down some of the tribalism on this AI question, I believe that ultimately long-term, there's a very interesting synthesis that can occur here where you begin to understand that culture is as important to AI as anything else. That actually, the ability for us to produce context, to produce diverse viewpoints on things, that's how you break the data wall. You break the data wall by making every moment, every observable moment, you know, not objective. I think that in the long term, at least this is my interpretation of these things, the two are actually incredibly, incredibly complementary. And you know what? Outside of a few agitators on social media networks, I believe that many of the people who most fundamentally understand AI also believe that. So that's why I'm still relatively optimistic on these things. Of course, there's incredible resource asymmetry and incredible challenges when it comes to literacy and so on and so forth. But fundamentally, if we're talking about the human project, these two things should actually be married, and more people need to perhaps, I believe, be putting forward that vision to say, look, you know, these aren't antagonistic goals. We want the cancer curing models. we want to be able to express ourselves in ever more rich and sophisticated and collaborative ways moving forward. We just need to find a way for everybody to participate in this and to bring their talents and their insights to it. And we'll all be better off in that scenario. Fingers crossed.
Thank you so much. We're kind of running out of time here. Just to close, finally, are there any upcoming projects or work that we should look out for in this space? I know you mentioned public diffusion earlier. Is there anything else that you have going on?
Yeah, so public diffusion models training and will be released. We have a bunch more. I mean, we have exhibitions this year, next year, the year after. There's a bunch of new things, you know, most of which is machine learning related, maybe just kind of building on some of the precedents we've set with prior work. There's a ton. I'm on Twitter all the time, so that's how I tend to communicate things very poorly. There's going to be a lot more. But nothing specifically to announce. I mean, the one thing I would announce maybe that we haven't mentioned is we released a retrospective book on our practice and a lot of these ideas called All Media is Training Data. And that is sold out, but we're trying to reprint it now. We're trying to print a second edition of it. So in case you are like titillated by some of these ideas, it's worth, I think we did a good job on the book. It's a fun read. And there's a lot of cool stuff to look at, which is, you know, basically looking at our practice, but also, you know, we invited in a lot of very bright and very knowledgeable people to kind of talk about where this AI situation is going, specifically related to culture and art. And I think there's some real good stuff in there. Yeah.
We'll definitely keep an eye out for that when you have a new printing of it. Thank you so much, Matt. This was a wonderful conversation. I feel like people are going to get a lot out of this. I certainly did. So I really appreciate you taking the time to chat.
No, of course, Andy. It's really my pleasure. I hope we get to cross paths again.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Looks Like New on KGNU's It's the Economy. Looks Like New is a show that asks old questions about new technology, coming to you from the Media Economies Design Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder, and is produced by Alexander Lipka. You can find us every month on air or online at lookslikenew.net or wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you'll join us next month. Thank you for listening.